Welcome back for another deep dive. Today, we're going interstellar, folks. We're talking about world ships, you know, those massive vessels designed to travel across the stars, the cosmic ocean. I've got to say, these academic papers you found are really something else.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's an area just ripe with challenges and possibilities. It really captures the imagination, that's for sure.
I'm ready to have my imagination captured.
All right, let's do it.
So we've got Kennedy's 2006 paper, Interstellar Travel, The Weight Calculation and the Incentive Trap of Progress, and section from Hine and his team, World Ships, Architectures, and Feasibility Revisited. Where do we even begin with all this?
Well, one of the big things that grabs you about interstellar travel is the time scale, right? We're talking journeys that could last centuries or even millennia. So the question becomes, when is the best time to launch? Would it be better to wait for better technology, maybe get there faster?
That's fascinating. It's like choosing between a slow boat today or waiting for a faster one later, except the ocean is space.
Exactly. And that's where Kennedy's weight calculation comes in. He suggests there's a sort of sweet spot for launching these missions.
A sweet spot, meaning if you wait too long, it doesn't actually save you any time.
You got it. Okay, so imagine our target is Barnard's star, about 6 light years away. Relatively close, cosmically speaking. But with the tech we could develop, you know, soon, that trip would be something like 12,000 years.
12,000 years. That's longer than, well, just about everything.
It really puts things into perspective. Now, compare that to something like Project Daedalus, which was a concept back in the 70s.
Oh, I remember reading about that. Wasn't that supposed to travel at a fraction of the speed of light?
110th, to be exact. So that would get you to Barnard's star in about 50 years.
50 years. That's practically a weekend trip in interstellar terms.
Oh, okay.
But there's got to be a catch, right?
Well, Daedalus was just a flyby. To actually stop at Barnard's star and hang out, you'd need to slow down, which would take another 50 years, not to mention a whole lot of fuel.
Right, so back to the weight calculation. You were saying that if technology improves, let's say speed doubles every 100 years, then it might actually make sense to just, well, wait.
Exactly. If we hold off for, say, 690 years, then with those speed increases, we could reach Barnard's star in just 100 years. Total travel time, 790 years.
Wow. So the folks who waited would actually get there thousands of years before the first group. It's mind-blowing to think about. Would you rather be a pioneer, knowing you might get overtaken, or would you wait for a faster ship?
Tough choice, right? It really shows the tension between our urge to explore and the reality of technological change. And the weight calculation isn't only about speed. We also need to factor in resources and energy.
Of course, you can't just magically make a spaceship go faster. The more speed, the more energy, and that means more resources, right?
Exactly. Now imagine we were using something like the technology from the New Horizons mission, which went to Pluto. Well, with that tech level, our most efficient wait time jumps to 969 years.
So it's all a trade-off, isn't it? Speed, time, resources. What would make you decide to launch?
That's the question, isn't it? It's kind of like choosing between a slow train and a hyperloop. Now, speaking of massive journeys, let's get into those world ships, those behemoths built for interstellar travel.
Okay, let's get into the nuts and bolts of what makes these things tick. What does Hine have to say about it?
Well, right off the bat, they point out the difficulty in just defining types of interstellar spacecraft. You have size, speed, and purpose to consider. It could be a little probe or a massive colony ship, or even, like we're talking about, a full-blown world ship.
So it's not just one size fits all for space travel. Makes sense.
Nope, not at all.
Yeah.
They give some examples to illustrate. You have the slowboat Ensmann spaceship going about 10% the speed of light. Then there's Matlock's colony ship at about 1%. And then Bond's world ship, even slower, crawling along at 0.5%. Each has its own pluses and minuses depending on what you're trying to do.
It's like choosing between a sailboat, a cargo ship, or a cruise liner. Each one for a different purpose.
Exactly. And then they also talk about 4 types of potential places to colonize, and these also influence the design of your spacecraft.
Oh, so it's not just finding an Earth 2.0 and setting up shop. There are more options.
Way more. You have habitable planets, you know, ready to go, like Earth. Then there's biocompatible, which could support life, but maybe need some tweaking to suit humans. And then there are planets you could terraform, meaning change them to be more like Earth.
So it's a spectrum from move-in ready to a fixer-upper. What's the fourth one?
Ah, the fourth one is actually building space colonies using resources found in the star system itself. So not a planet at all, but like a giant self-sustaining space station.
Wow, that's like going full nomad, building your own mobile home out in space.
Yeah.
That really opens up the possibilities.
It does. And the authors point out that systems with resources to build those space colonies might be way more common than systems with habitable planets.
Yeah, after all, there are a lot more asteroids and comets than Earth-like planets. Do they mention any star systems that would be good for that?
They do, actually. They bring up Epsilon Eridani, which is relatively close to us and has a lot of those small bodies, so it could be great for resource gathering and building space colonies.
Fascinating. So choosing your destination is just as important as building the right ship. But what about the people on these world ships traveling for generations? How do you keep their society and culture going?
You've hit a crucial point. Crew size? How it relates to preserving knowledge? That's what we need to explore next.
Okay, I'm ready to dive into that. Knowledge preservation on a world ship.
Sounds intense. It is, trust me. So knowledge preservation, it really is essential when you're talking about a journey lasting generations.
It's not just about keeping the lights on. You need to maintain a whole civilization with all its knowledge and skills. How do you even begin to tackle that?
Well, the paper actually talks about some research on how well larger populations retain knowledge and how it's transmitted. Huh. You know, think about isolated cultures throughout history.
Like those Polynesian islanders who navigated the Pacific using the stars.
Yeah.
But their knowledge depended on a really strong community.
Exactly. Now imagine a small crew on a world ship. They try their best, but knowledge can still fade over time, you know? What if they forget how to make microchips or maintain those complex life support systems?
Now that's a scary thought. Losing essential knowledge out there in the middle of nowhere. Is there like a magic number for crew size? Enough people to make sure that doesn't happen.
Well, it would be nice if it were that simple. But the paper suggests a few things. One idea is sending multiple world ships, you know, so they can share knowledge and stay connected.
Like a backup hard drive for human civilization.
Yeah, something like that. They also talk about keeping in touch with Earth so they can exchange info and technology.
But wouldn't communication be a problem? The farther away they get, the longer it takes for messages to travel.
Right. Even at the speed of light, it takes years for a reply. So then they suggest setting up special institutions on the ship, like libraries, universities, even research labs, yeah, dedicated to keeping that knowledge alive.
So basically a mini society designed to last for centuries. A Noah's Ark for human knowledge.
I like that analogy. And of course, they mention using AI and expert systems, you know, to help teach, preserve, and manage all that information.
Right. AI could be essential in education, research, even government, especially on a world ship.
Mm.
But what about the ship itself? How do you keep something that complex running for centuries?
Ah, that's where reliability comes in. It's a big deal in both papers. You know, the longer the trip, the more likely things will break down.
And no handy repair shops out in interstellar space.
Nope, definitely not. So how do you design a world ship to last? Well, they talk about making it modular so you can easily repair or replace things.
So it's like building it with Lego blocks. Swap out the broken parts without dismantling the whole thing.
That's the idea. And then you need a good system to find and fix problems quickly. They actually got some inspiration from Project Daedalus, which had plans for a massive automated repair system.
Robot mechanics.
Right.
But even with robots, you still need spare parts, right? Where do you store all that on a ship that's already huge?
Well, this is where it gets even more interesting. They discuss repair by repair, where you recycle and reuse broken parts. So instead of a warehouse full of spares, you have a whole system for breaking things down and making new parts.
So you're basically bringing a whole recycling plant along for the ride. It's like having a little industrial ecosystem where waste turns into resources.
Exactly. And the team behind Daedalus actually said that this repair by repair was their only hope for making such a mission even possible. A closed loop system that minimizes waste and uses resources as efficiently as possible.
That's amazing. But there's always a chance of something unexpected happening, right?
Sure.
Things nobody could have planned for.
Absolutely. And that leads us to probably the most intriguing question of all. What happens to those people on board? Their culture, their sense of identity? How does that change after generations in isolation?
Yeah, we've talked about preserving knowledge and technology, but what about the human element? Will they still be the same people, the same culture, when they reach their destination centuries later?
That's the million-dollar question, and one that both Kennedy and Hine grapple with. There's no easy answer.
It's like this huge social experiment. Take a slice of humanity, stick it in a bottle, and launch it across the galaxy. What comes out the other side?
That's what fascinates me. Would they even consider themselves human in the same way we do? Their values, their beliefs, their whole understanding of the universe, it could all be completely different. Really makes you think, doesn't it? All those things they'd face on a world ship, the choices they'd make, how their society could change over time.
It's incredible, really. And then there's the whole question of what does it even mean to be human in that context?
Yeah, like if they're relying on AI for knowledge, for decisions, does that affect their freedom, their sense of self?
That's a good point. We were talking about AI helping to preserve and pass on knowledge, but what if it becomes, you know, more than that? What if the AI runs the life support, navigates the ship, maybe even makes important decisions?
That's not out of the realm of possibility. And as new generations are born on the world ship, AI is a constant presence. It's more than a tool. It's part of their whole world.
It's almost like, you know those stories about children raised by wolves? They adapt to that environment. Their behavior changes. Would growing up with AI on a world ship be anything like that, do you think?
That's an interesting thought. Could be we'd see all sorts of unique cultural practices, beliefs, even ways of thinking, influenced by the world ship and their reliance on AI.
It makes you wonder, would they even consider themselves human in the same way we do? Or would they see themselves as something different, a new kind of human shaped by this incredible journey?
It's a question that goes deeper than just definitions. Makes us think about what really makes us human. Biology, history. Or is it something more, something that changes over time?
That's a big question to be thinking about, especially when we're talking about space travel. But I think you're right. It's important to look beyond the technical stuff. There's the social side, the cultural side, even the philosophical side, you know, the human side of all this.
Definitely. And those are important things to think about, even if we're just speculating right now. Helps us imagine what the future could be like and maybe even understand the challenges we face today.
I like that. So any final thoughts for our listeners before we wrap things up? Anything that might inspire them to dig deeper?
Definitely check out the papers we've been discussing. They're really fascinating. But also, don't be afraid to let your imagination run wild. Think about the possibilities, the problems, what it would all mean. Like, what would you pack for a journey that lasts centuries? What kind of society would you create on a world ship?
Wow, those are great questions to think about. And maybe someday these thought experiments won't be just thought experiments anymore, you know?
Yeah, maybe someday we'll be here to see humanity take its first steps to the stars.
That's a future I'd love to witness. Well, a big thanks to everyone for joining us on this deep dive into interstellar travel and world ships. We hope you learned some cool stuff and maybe even got inspired to think about the future in a new way.
Until next time, keep looking up.
And keep dreaming big, folks. That's what it's all about.